The Northwest at 4, humidity at 96%. It is 68 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admission/transfer. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be speaking for the next few minutes about one of the NFL's most famous families, a family with 3 first-rate quarterbacks. We're talking about the Manning family. That would be the father, Archie, and his 2 sons, Peyton and Eli. And the book at hand is In the Name of the Father, Family Football and the Manning Dynasty. And the author, Mark Hrabowski, has been on the morning show before, most recently, I believe, to talk about his biography of the Supremes, a very different threesome from the 3 Mannings that we're going to be talking about today. And the Manning family form a very interesting legacy, and their stories are quite fascinating in and of themselves, and also sort of the story of the dynamic of the family as a whole. I'm excited about the next few minutes to talk about the book again called In the Name of the Father. Mark Hrabowski, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
What drew you to the story of the Mannings in the first place? What piqued your interest enough to make it a big project for you?
I guess you might call this the boy group, huh? You know, instead of the girl group. No, as you said, the context of the story is just fascinating. I don't think it's really been taken for that by people. It's, you know, because of their, you know, their flash and you know, the name, you know, and their brand and everything like that. But I saw it almost like a novel. You know, I'm a northern boy. I'm a New Yorker, but I am absolutely fascinated by Southern culture, Southern literature, music. I've done books on Hank Williams, Tom Landry, people who are associated with the soil of the South, you know, the mud, the dirt of the South, the ethos of the South. And this is a real Southern tale here. This is almost like a Tennessee Williams play. In fact, Tennessee Williams was a neighbor of the Mannings' grandfather, grandmother and grandfather in Drew, Mississippi, early in the 20th century, Thomas Lanier, right? Williams. And he wrote about people like the Manning family, not specifically, of course, but people like them who made their whole lives digging cotton, you know, picking cotton in the fields and just living day to day and getting satisfaction from where they could take it. And that was really, really the Manning family in Mississippi. This is long before Archie went to New Orleans and made his, you know, his pro name there, unfortunately, with the Saints. This is when he grew up in Mississippi, and the forces surrounding him were all that Southern history, the plantation society, the antebellum South, the good and the bad of that heritage. And that's what I really wanted to incorporate in this book, make it almost sound like a novel, because here you have a lot of twists and turns, a lot of Shakespearean kind of tragedy, his own father committing suicide and Archie finding him at 19, when he was 19 years old, and turning him into a man on the spot and having to live with that searing tragedy his whole life thereafter. And that sort of continued into the saga of his sons, all the twists and turns that they took. The oldest one, of course, being Cooper, who was supposedly the best athlete of the three Manning sons, who was the first to go to college and went to enrolled in Ole Miss, but never could play because he was diagnosed with stenosis of the spine. And that was a crushing blow to the family because they expected Cooper to carry on Archie's tradition at Ole Miss. And it affected Peyton, too, because Peyton had been Cooper's quarterback in high school in New Orleans, at Newman High School. And they expected to continue that at Ole Miss, being the quarterback-receiver combination. Cooper wasn't a quarterback. He was a receiver. But that never happened, and I think it played into why Peyton did not go to Ole Miss, which really broke Archie's heart at the time. But then Eli comes along, and he closes the chain by going to Ole Miss and breaking Archie's old records. You know, so it's a fascinating story before they ever hit the pros.
Absolutely. Right? It really is. And, of course, their experiences in the pros are another fascinating story as well.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about the tone of the book. Just the general tone in which you talk about the Mannings and the choice you made with that tone. And I have no bone to pick with the tone. I mean, I actually like the tone, but it's interesting. A book like this could be written in very sort of reverential terms, or the book could be a book that's all about exposing skeletons in the closet all of their faults and failings or whatever. And I think you've adopted a tone that is a really intriguing mix. Can you talk about that, about the tone, kind of the perspective that your book takes about these three gentlemen?
Well, I appreciate that because that's how I roll, basically. I mean, I take a story and tell it the way it happened. With the truth, you know, or the warts and all, but also paying homage when necessary. I mean, there's so much good about the Manning family. I'm a fan of the Manning family. You know, I want Peyton's son to come along in 15 years or so and continue the legacy. I mean, in the last 47 years, there's been a Manning at quarterback in the NFL for 33 of those years. So, I mean, it's like an unending dynasty, and you know. What can you say about the Manning brand? I mean, it's the top brand in sports. But, yeah, the way I handle anything, any story is to just tell it the way it happened. You know, inject some context, inject some maybe some personal bias, some personal leanings, you know, when necessary. But not to play too heavily toward sensationalism, as you say. There's a lot of things about the Mannings. You know, the whole business with the trainer at Tennessee, and you know that lingers on and on because Peyton simply seems to not be able to let it go for some reason there. And I had to inject my opinion that there's some sexism involved in there because I don't think he would have done that with a male trainer. I don't think we ever would have, you know, heard of it at all if it was a male trainer.
Right. We should mention to our listeners.
Had his own problems in college. He was arrested for public drunkenness. And I suppose, as you say, a lot of writers would concentrate on that, blow that up and make it into a sort of tell-all, you know, bogus, sensational, whatever. But that's just part of the story.
Right.
It's just part of the story.
I think
and
this
I,
is...
I try to tell whatever book I do, just to put it in the context of the times these people, you know, inhabited. And with the Mannings, that's a good deal of time. And it encompasses a lot of changes in Southern culture, especially when they were in college. Don't forget that Archie used to come out on the field at Ole Miss, carrying the Confederate flag, you know, with Colonel Reb, you know, to the strains of Dixie. There were overt symbols of racism at Mississippi University at the time. Not that Archie was a racist, and not that he was, you know, particularly happy doing that, but it's what any Southern star athlete would be called upon to do at Mississippi. But even so, Archie had some condition, you know, was conditioned to believe in certain things that a Southern guy would have been conditioned to do in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And I don't make any bones about that. I'm not going to protect anybody, you know, by ignoring something like that.
Sure.
But it's just part of the overall story. There's so many facets in the story It's just endless.
Right. In fact, I think one of the things that's most interesting about the book is that, you know, we're talking about these three guys, and they are each their own person. They are not carbon copies of each other, and yet they are all part of the same family. They all came out of the South. They all are football players. And so there's this intriguing blend of similarities and differences. At one point, you call them three sides of the same coin. I think it's a great way to put it.
Well, it's so true, too, because, you know, in the end, they're all like the Three Musketeers. In the end, they're, you know, one is for all is for one. But they all went their own separate paths. Even Peyton and Eli, I mean, their paths were totally different. Their personalities are totally different. Their impulses are totally different. Their generations are totally different. Because Eli's 5 years younger than Peyton and very rarely participated in any, you know, games, activities with Peyton and his buddies in his circle. And Peyton was younger than Cooper, who had his own circle, you know. And they're so different in personality that if you blend them all, they make up a perfect person. But each one is so different. It's, you know, Cooper's was the cut-up, the class clown, and Peyton was the anal, detail-oriented teenager with a voracious competitiveness and ambition. And Eli was none of those. Eli was, in fact, so insulated as a child that they thought he had learning disabilities, and they had to take him to psychiatrists, and, you know, had to get him out of his shell, believe it or not. And that was, in large part, the doing of their mother, Olivia, who was the sort of the unsung hero, the power behind the throne. She was really the one who raised them all. And, you know, that's quite a thing to say about it. You know, a woman of the, you know, 50s, 60s, you know, bringing up three young men in a totally different generation, you know. So I give her a lot of credit. She's sort of the queen, you know, of our sports culture.
Deservedly so. We're speaking with Mark Hrabowski. We're talking about his newest book, which is called In the Name of the Father, Family, Football, and the Manning Dynasty. The book is about Archie Manning and his two sons, Peyton and Eli. I mean, that's two of his three sons who, as Archie did, went on to be NFL quarterbacks. And it's a very, very intriguing story. Of the three, of course, the typical person today, especially anybody who's relatively young, is less likely to know about the greatness of Archie Manning as a football player himself. And really, his talent as a quarterback cannot really be overstated, and just his talent as an athlete in general. What do you think is most important for us to know in order to appreciate the greatness of quarterback Archie Manning?
Yeah, it's so amazing, too, because somebody went back to Drew a few years ago, Drew, Mississippi, where Archie grew up and made his name as a high school quarterback. And he went to the old high school, which is now closed. And the town is totally different. It was almost all white then. It's almost all African-American now. And at the school, you know, the reporter asked the kids, like, you know, do you know the Mannings? And it's, oh, yeah, Peyton. We know Peyton. And he brought up, do you know Archie? And they say, no, we don't even know who Archie is. And Archie was the one who put the school and the town on the map. And this is so, I mean, this is about 40, the span of what, 40 years or so, 40, 50 years. So in the culture, Archie is forgotten as a quarterback. He exists as Peyton and Eli's daddy in those commercials that they do for ESPN, which are great commercials, by the way, because those guys, all of those guys have great deadpan humor, especially Archie, who says so little, but, you know, he's got it in his eyes, in his face. You know, but at the time, man, he was the Southern athlete of all time. You know, he probably replaced Chucking Charlie Connerly as the greatest Southern quarterback at that time. He was all SEC. He was, you know, all the rage. But again, this tragedy enters early because he never quite achieved, you know, the ultimate. He never won a Heisman. Ole Miss never won a national title under him when he was there as a quarterback. And, you know, there was that undercurrent of, you know, good, great, but maybe not great enough. And, you know, that lingers with Archie. Hmm. It hurts Archie that he never achieved what he could have and should have. Just imagine if he had been drafted by the, let's say, the Cowboys instead of the Saints, right? He might have been Roger Staubach before Staubach. Hmm. Because those two were very similar in style. They were running quarterbacks who could also throw the long ball. But Archie had to suffer and go to the Saints and just be dragged down year after year by teams with no offensive line, no running game, just terrible teams. And he ate a lot of dirt. He was sacked 12 times in a game once by the Bears.
Hmm.
You know. So and yet he persevered, and he became the NFC Player of the Year one year late in his career, which was a real triumph for him because
right.
he was still a bad team.
And yeah. and we should and we should
he
make
was the greatest quarterback. They wrote songs about him. They wrote the Ballad of Archie Who, you know, songs about this guy.
And
today he's really just Archie and. I mean, he's Peyton and Eli's dad.
Right. We should make sure that people understand how highly touted he was as an NFL rookie. I mean, and how highly paid.
Okay, he was a first-round number one draft choice, you know. And
So expectations yeah. ran really high, but of course, in those 13 seasons with the NFL, as you just said, he was never able to achieve the greatness that his talent might have suggested.
And he held every record. At Ole Miss, and which were later broken by his son, Eli. I mean, that's like a closing of the circle right there, you know, because the game had changed by the time Eli came around. It was much more passing. Archie's day was, you know, the 3 yards in a cloud of dust kind of thing. But he was a great running quarterback, which you never would deduce that by watching his sons, because you know they're kind of slow footed and plodding. And Archie was like a gazelle out there. You know, he would run 80 yards down the sideline on a keeper. He was just a great quarterback, and it's just what happened to him was, you know, I'm sure he curses his fate what happened to him and really wonders why he never became the great star that he should have been.
Right. And, of course, one of the things that is intriguing to think about is – what it's like for him to see his two sons achieve greatness in the NFL that he never achieved, which in turn brings to mind Archie Manning's relationship with his own father, Buddy, and what it was like yeah. for Buddy to see Archie achieve the success that he did. I mean, it is so intriguing to think about kind of the good and the bad that is tied up in one's own son's achieving greatness that you wish you yourself could have achieved.
Yeah, it's when you're talking about a suicide, and a totally unexpected suicide of a respected businessman, you know, good father, smart guy, good athlete, introduced his sons to football. Why a guy like that would take his own life? You know, there are a lot of layers. We'll never know. I mean, the only one who knew was Buddy himself. But I think you put your finger on it, and a lot of it might have had to do with the fact that his son was so outshining him at only, you know, 15, 16 years old, was like the talk of the town, was, you know, the galvanizing force of the whole town and Drew. And then when he went to Ole Miss, of course, he was, you know, so far overshadowed his father. His father, I mean, obviously on one level, the father was very proud of him. Could not have been prouder of, you know, taking the Manning name and, you know, and making it a national, you know, household name. And, you know, on that level, sure. But on another level, he was stuck in a dead-end job back there selling farm equipment, you know, chasing after people who owed him money. And he was not his health declined very, very fast. He smoked endlessly, chain smoked day to day. Did not take care of himself, had the cancer, and didn't follow doctor's orders, and just his life became a shambles, and he fell into a whole nexus of depression that nobody could bring him out of, and he wound up, you know, killing himself. But how, you have to wonder why he did it the way he did. I mean, he rigged this rudimentary contraption with a stick and a string tied to the trigger of a rifle. so that he could get the angle right and shooting himself in the head. It's just a horrible, horrible story. But the worst part of it is that his son, the son that he loved and had so much pride in, yet, you know, may have actually resented on some level. And he knew the son would find him because the family was out at a wedding that day. And Archie said he was going to come home early to have a barbecue with Buddy. So he knew Archie would walk in the door and find his dead body. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine planning something like that?
Right.
What must have been going through his mind?
Right.
You know.
What?
And Archie had to live with the baggage of that, and still does.
Right.
You can never get that out of your mind, out of your soul.
Of course.
But he dealt with it the best way he could by separating himself from emotion. Archie's he's on the surface a very unemotional man. And I think that was a defense mechanism, partly as a way of dealing with Buddy's suicide.
Hmm. You tell us that Archie Manning himself does not pretend he was the perfect father to his three sons. But nevertheless, he obviously has done a whole lot of things right. Say a word about the kind of father he has been, particularly to Peyton and Eli over the years.
Yeah, this actually follows on the Buddy thing, because I think he consciously wanted to be a better father to his sons than Buddy was to him. Because, you know, Buddy tried, but he just wasn't. He was that way. He wasn't made that way. He wasn't built to be a father. He wasn't an emotional or a man who showed his warmth and love. And Archie's, you know, in the name of his father, was sort of the same way. But he made an effort to spend time when he could with the three boys. He made a lot of home movies that, you know, have been seen in documentaries about the family, where when they were young and he would throw them passes from the balcony of their home in the Garden District in New Orleans, and, you know, tried to be there for that. And he's gone to so many of their games. He's crisscrossed the country. You know, I mean, he's put a lot of mileage into seeing his sons. He and Olivia both. You know, they would go from a Peyton game to an Eli game in high school. And then in the pros, they go from a Peyton Colt game to an Eli Giant game. You know, they were constantly on the road. But it was a double-edged sword for Archie because as I said in the book, he once said, "I hate this game now." He hates, because what he was referring to was the pressure of watching his sons having to win in these, and they took so many losses, so many epic defeats along the way that it killed him too. So yeah, he almost has a love-hate relationship with football now because of watching his sons lose so much. But they also won it. You know, they've won four times, won four rings.
Yeah,
and you know, it's part of the yin and yang of being Archie. The good and the bad.
Right. Speaking of the good and the bad, you write about how Peyton Manning, who of course is now retired, you say his legacy is unfairly damned by faint praise as the best regular season quarterback in history. And of course, what you're referring to there is that when it comes to postseason play, his record was 14-13, which is not great compared to other great players, namely Tom Brady, chief among them, as someone who seemed to like come into his own in the postseason. Yeah, or Eli, for that matter. I think that's so intriguing because, of course, in so many ways, Peyton Manning was a stunning quarterback and achieved so much and broke so many records, and yet there is this slight sense of not quite being all he could have been that reminds us of the mixed legacy of Archie Manning as well.
Yeah, this is why it's such a great story. If they had just come along and if he had been Tom Brady, because there's a lot of undercurrent with Brady too, of, you know, crushing defeats and whatever. They're always, for an athlete, it's never 100%. But if he had been like Brady and he had won most of the time, it wouldn't have been as good a story. You know, and if Archie had been like Staubach and, you know, immediately made a team a winner in the NFL, it would have been a great story, but it wouldn't have been the story that it is now, which is so human. You know, I mean, what can you say about the man? You know, Peyton lost to Brady 14 out of 21 games. which is terrible. But the last time they met, you know, the second to last game of Peyton's career, Peyton won and went to the Super Bowl and won the Super Bowl, even though he didn't do much. And, you know, he was a shell of himself and the defense won it. But, again, this is how all things come around full circle with the Manning.
You know? Right, right.
In the end, it's a happy ending. It's a good story. But there's so much pain to go through.
Right.
To get there, that's really the story.
Right, and in some ways it makes Peyton Manning a much more compelling figure. You tell us that, in a sense, those really painful postseason defeats, that devastation humanized Peyton Manning in the eyes of many, and that's maybe one reason why you say Brady is the better quarterback, Peyton Manning is the better icon.
And because he's more human than Brady, and he had to be. Because he had to deal with defeat, and people like that always get a lot more sympathy. They become more human. I just finished a book that'll be out next year on Don Shula, and it's the same way. You know, he the most wins in history and the only perfect season, yet only two championships in all those years. You know, and the biggest upset defeat in history is on his shoulders, the Jets in Super Bowl III. Mm. So it's the same kind of thing. These people have to endure so much and live with defeat that they never thought that they would have. Hmm. Peyton lost his first seven games to Brady. He was probably thinking, I'm never going to beat this guy.
Hmm.
But he just hung in there, and, you know, in the end, he has the better stats, or he did when he retired. And so that's why I call him, you know, the best quarterback based on all the objective numbers. The best icon because of all the pain he went through. But Brady is going to, by the time he's through, is going to have all the records anyway, right?
Hmm.
So he's going to be the best, objectively, empirically, the best quarterback and the most championships.
Right, if not the best story.
But is Brady on all those commercials? I mean, I'm waiting for the next round of Peyton commercials to hit when the season begins, you know? It's 3 years since he's retired. I think his jersey is still like the number two or three best-selling jersey in football. Would that be the case with Brady? I don't think so.
Probably not. Let's spend a few minutes talking about Eli, and he is a really interesting story in and of himself. You call him at one point hero and anti-hero at once, and you quote one of his own centers at one point calling him one of the most unathletic quarterbacks in the NFL. There are ways in which the success story of Eli Manning is a really big surprise. How has he managed to achieve what he has, including two Super Bowl rings?
Yeah, he's the Billy Baldwin, as you know, the joke was, and then one of those ESPN shows where Alec Baldwin asked Archie, who's, you know, Peyton or Eli, and you know, he said, well, you answer me, who, you know, Alec or Billy, and it's true that Eli is sort of a Billy Baldwin. He'll never be on that same level of recognition, fame, even love in some cases for Peyton, although he had his enemies too. Eli doesn't really have enemies. He is such an even, they used to call him Easy Eli, you know, because he's such a laid-back kind of guy. And not on the field, of course. I mean, he's a terror, when, you know, on the field. But you don't really know what makes him tick. He's so inscrutable that, you know, one of the Giants said, you know, he puts all that on just to, as a defense mechanism, so he doesn't have to answer a lot of hard questions and whatever, and that might be true, but I just don't think Eli knows himself who he is. I don't think Eli can sum up, you know, what he would do if he wasn't a quarterback. Because, you know, what would he? We know with Peyton, he could probably be an actor, or you know, he could. Who knows what he could be? A businessman. But Eli, you know, we just don't know because he hides behind that facade of, you know, almost bizarre behavior sometimes. You know, where he says things that don't make sense. So, I mean, I like him because he reflects his generation, Generation X. I mean, he reflects that the way Archie reflected the baby boomer generation. Mm. You know?
Interesting.
He's not a guy you can easily figure out, but I think he's, you know, he's content with that.
Right.
He's content with fooling people.
You also tell us,
he gets a kick out of it.
You also tell us he's often characterized as the bumpkin brother, the country bumpkin brother, but his IQ is probably the highest of all three Mannings. And someone you quote says, Eli is smart. He's playing chess while everyone else is playing checkers. What are the most important examples of Eli Manning's smarts, his intelligence?
Well, you remember when the Giants, a couple of years, when they were still good and going to the playoffs, you know, they were going to go to Green Bay and for the first playoff game, and Beckham and a couple of other, you know, receivers, and, you know, went down to Miami instead of, you know, hanging out and practicing, getting ready for the game. They went down and were on a boat, you know, in Miami and everything. So Eli had to be the one to sort of take the pressure off them, and he did. He was very canny about it. He said, you know, I was very disappointed. So everybody hunched forward, all the reporters, like, what's he going to say? Is he going to dump on his own teammates? He said, I'm very disappointed in the clothes they took down there. They wore flip-flops and shorts, and, you know, they should have dressed better, and, you know, they shouldn't have taken their shirts off. I wouldn't have done that, which is a good thing because nobody wants to see Eli with his shirt off. But he sort of diffused the situation, you know, the way nobody else could. And so that, you know, in his mind, he knew how to do that. He knew how to play the press like that. If you would expect Peyton to do something like that, because Peyton was so wise when it came to communicating with the media. But you didn't expect it with Eli.
Right.
So, you know, unfortunately, they didn't do very well in the game in Green Bay. But, you know, that was an example of Eli being a leader of the team. And by God, if he's not a leader by now, after all these years, I don't know when he couldn't be a leader. So, you know, it's up to him now to get that team back on track, and we'll see how he does.
Right. And you tell us Eli has set out to be not Peyton. And, of course, we could read those words about somebody, and the implication would be that there is real estrangement between them. But, of course, that's not the case with Eli Manning and Peyton Manning, although there are probably a couple of ways in which the relationship between them is in some ways maybe a little bit uneasy. But by and large, it sounds like these are loving brothers.
Yeah, well, you know what? It's almost like they're not it's almost like Peyton was a father figure to Eli. Because I said before, he's 5 years older, and he had achieved so much success in high school when Eli was just a young kid, you know, and the separation between those two was great. Peyton was dealing at a whole different level in his circles, but they always, yes, something about the blood here, you know, something about the way they hang together and every, you know, the Three Musketeers all for one. And that's the way it is. Even with the separations between the two and the different personalities, They always, you know, were very much, I mean, all the tragedies and everything that happened, in a way, you know, Cooper had to live his dream through Peyton, right? I mean, and he did. I mean, he did. He's content to do that. Of course, making $12 million a year as an energy trader doesn't hurt either.
Right.
He's a very talented guy, Cooper.
And by the way, I am so glad you pointed out the fact that Peyton wears number 18 in the NFL, or wore number 18 in the NFL, specifically to honor his brother Cooper. I did not know that till I read your book.
Which was honoring Archie originally, Cooper, because Archie wore that as a pro. Hmm. I mean, he wore that in college. He wore that at Ole Miss. Hmm. They have the speed limit there at 18 because of Archie Manning. You know, so it's the little symbolic gestures like that, you know, that keep them bonded. And you can see when they do those commercials, they're not acting. They have a real love for each other. Again, that's the doing of Olivia in many ways, because, you know, Archie is not an overtly warm man. He's almost standoffish, you know. But she gave them their human qualities, their personalities, and, you know, it's still there today. They don't spend a lot of time together anymore, but they'll be at that Manning Passing Academy every year down in Louisiana, because that's a family thing that was started by Archie. He expects all the family to be there, and they're there.
Right. In
and
fact,
that's the way it is.
You quote Archie as saying that for the last 20 years, Peyton and Eli and Cooper have been there, and they have not missed a minute of it. I mean, they could not be more devoted to that that annual event, that that passing clinic, that the Manning Passing Academy, which says a lot about this family and their devotion to this game and to each other.
It's the only time you'll see Peyton pick up a football now, which is, you know, I mean, that might be the reason to go to that thing.
Wow.
Because, you know, he's not a football player anymore, but families will pay a lot of money just to, you know, have the kid go and see Peyton throw a couple of wobbly passes now, because that's the brand. That's the Manning brand, you know, that pose of Peyton throwing a football. It's like almost like the Jerry West NBA logo. You know, Peyton throwing a football could be the NFL logo. So, you know, that's what they go for.
Hmm. A last quick question. Did any of the Mannings cooperate with you in the writing of this book, and or was that, did you even seek out that cooperation?
No, I didn't. I didn't even seek it out, because Archie and Peyton did a dual autobiography some time ago, actually a long time ago, 2000, for which Peyton got in trouble because he brought up that Jamie Norwright thing again, the trainer, and when he was supposed to be a gag order on it. And so, you know, he got in trouble there. But they did that, and Eli would never cooperate. I mean, Eli wouldn't know what to say, you know, in a writing about himself, talking about himself. But you're right, I didn't want that. I didn't want that because I didn't want it to be – it's not their book. It's my book.
Hmm.
You know, it's my – I would never want to feel that I was under pressure to slant, you know, the theme or the content in any way. And you do that when you bring a person into a project. It's going to be their project, you know. And, they've said enough. They've said enough to fill 50 books. So I just wanted to put it all in the proper context and tell it the way, you know, it should be told.
Well, I think you've really done that. The book, again, is titled In the Name of the Father, Family, Football, and the Manning Dynasty, published by Live Right Publishing, a division of W.W. Norton, and the author, Mark Hrabowski. Mark Hrabowski, congrats on a really entertaining and illuminating book. And thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Oh, thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
And the time is 8:47 here on WGTD. And for part two of today's program, an excerpt from the interview that I conducted with Kat Duff, the author of an intriguing book called The Secret Life of Sleep, published by Atria Books. In this book, Kat Duff explores the nature of sleep, why we sleep, and especially what happens to us while we sleep. We tend to think of sleep very much as kind of an empty and maybe pointless time, when in fact there's a great deal going on beneath the surface.
But in fact, lots goes on in our sleep. We keep thinking and feeling and going over things in our sleep. We practice our skills. We remember things. We weigh variables. We solve problems. Have you ever had the experience of being bothered by something when you go to bed and you wake up the next morning and you get in the shower and all of a sudden it dawns on you, oh, this is what I need to do? That's because your sleep has been working on it and figuring it out. So they do relate very much to each other, but they have this kind of invisible line between them.
Mm-hmm. I remember that from, I think, the 11th chapter of your book, Knitting Up the Reveled Sleeve of Care, Emotional Restoration, when you tell us that that we are beginning to understand the role that sleep and dreams play in what you describe as managing the emotions that often get the better of us by day. Do we understand the mechanism by which that restoration or process of kind of making sense of things, how that happens when we sleep, when we dream? What's going on?
We're learning more. We don't understand it all, of course. But part of what we do in our dreaming lives, and by the way, even people who don't remember dreams still dream. That's been pretty well established, is that we kind of reiterate any the issues that are bothering us and kind of dramatize them in different ways in order to scale down the upset, in a sense. I think that's why the Irish say, you know, a good laugh and a long sleep are the best cures. Or it's also said the best bridge between despair and hope is a good night's sleep. How exactly we make that shift from being overwhelmed and discouraged and despairing at night and waking up the next morning and ready to take on the day involves both the dreaming sleep where we go over the things that are bothering us, but also that deep sleep where we let it all go and we kind of empty out. And I think it's the combination of the two that really does the trick.
Hmm. Of course, there are all kinds of people who have all kinds of difficulty with sleep, with falling asleep, with remaining asleep, and it seems like these are numbers which are escalating. One of the most curious phenomena, of course, is the fear of falling asleep. You give us a couple of different names for that, hypnophobia or somnophobia. It's such an intriguing, and I'm sure for the people who suffer from it, very, very troubling condition. What do we know about this curious experience of those who are actually fearful of falling asleep? What is going on there?
Well, it's kind of a hypervigilance. You know how if we're walking down a dark street at night, we have all our antennae out to see, you know, what's lurking in the shadows, if there's any danger around. We're hyper-alert. We're hyper-vigilant. Some people, their nervous systems have a hard time letting go of that hypervigilance. And I have a couple of friends who are like this, who are chronic insomniacs. They get close to sleep and then something suddenly wakes them up. Wait a minute, what if this or that is going on? What do I have to listen to? It may be carried over from times in our evolution or our history when we lived in more dangerous times, when more was afoot that we had to watch out for, or it may be a function of being overstimulated in our world. Now we have, you know, lights and sounds and TVs and everything is blaring, it seems. And it could also be a function of when people have been left alone to cry as babies too often. What can happen is that their nervous systems get extra sensitive to stress and extra taut, and then they may grow up to be people who can't fall asleep or stay asleep.
One really intriguing thing in your book is when you talk about the booming sleep industry, and in particular how sleeping pills are such an important, profitable part of the pharmaceutical industry, and yet you tell us very persuasive evidence that indicates that, in fact, most sleeping medications, sleep aids, do almost nothing to actually help people sleep. Tell us more about what these studies show.
Yeah, it's remarkable. One in four Americans take a sleep medication every night. And what the studies show is that on average, sleeping pills give us an extra 11 minutes of sleep. What they do is they usually shorten the time it takes to fall asleep. So there's less time for that anxiety and that sleep dread to build up. More importantly, what they do is they lower anxiety, so we just feel less worried about whether we're going to get enough sleep or not. And we don't remember our nights when we wake up in the morning, so it feels like we're more rested when actually we just got 11 more minutes. And in fact, most sleeping pills will actually shorten the time we spend in dream sleep and in the deep sleep that is so physically regenerating. So chronic use of sleeping pills will actually accelerate our aging because we don't spend as much time in that deep regenerating sleep.
Interesting. And it's so interesting. You tell us about these results and then you write, I can hear my friends who take Ambien nightly protest that it is not true, insisting they sleep more and do better the next day with the drug. But you tell us lab studies consistently report that people think they get more sleep when they take medication than they actually do. In other words, people do not generally do all that good a job of assessing their own sleep, and in particular, how their sleep has been positively or adversely affected by something.
That's true, because, of course, we don't remember our sleep. An interesting study has come out since I wrote the book, demonstrating that if someone is told they had a good sleep, they actually do much better that day and perform much better as if they did have a better sleep, even if they didn't. So there's a certain value in that placebo effect of thinking that you got better sleep than you did, but of course it's limited.
Hmm. Well, and when I underwent my sleep study, one of the things that was difficult for me was to answer all the preliminary questions about typically how a night of sleep unfolds for me. And then when I had that first sleep study and awoke the next morning, it was very difficult for me to answer those questions, such as how many times did you wake up? How long were you up? I mean, how long did you deeply sleep? Did you dream? I realized that those were all questions that were really hard for me to answer. And of course, that circles us right back to one of the first points we made in this interview, that the study of sleep is very, very difficult. And it probably always will be.
I think you're right. Stanley Korn, who was one of the wrote the earliest books about sleep, told this great story. He said that he had a really bad night of sleep. He was awake all night. In the morning, he was telling his wife when she woke up, "Oh, I never slept. It was terrible." And then they noticed there was dust on the bed, and he looked up, and the ceiling had cracked, and plaster had fallen onto the bed. They had slept through the earthquake in San Francisco, and he thought he had never slept. So our perceptions oftentimes of our sleep, insomniacs saying that I didn't sleep a wink, or people saying I slept great the whole night, are sometimes off from what really happened.
Right. I mean, those electrodes attached to your temples, those don't lie. But
they
sometimes paint a picture that's really hard for us to understand. Well, for much more information about the mysterious experience of sleep and its undeniable benefits, we can turn to your book, again titled The Secret Life of Sleep. It's published by Atria Books, the author, Kat Duff. Kat Duff, thank you so much. I was intrigued by your book on so many levels, and I know many people will find a lot to drink in and ponder. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
It's 8:58 here on WGTD. We have a lineup of very interesting morning shows next week, beginning on Monday with Christian DiSpigna, author of Founding Martyr, The Life and Death of Dr. Joseph Warren, the American Revolution's Lost Hero. Dr. Warren was a leading figure in the years right up before the American Revolution. Unfortunately, he died at Bunker Hill, but otherwise we would very likely remember him as one of our most important founding fathers. It's a fascinating story. Tuesday, a Carthage student by the name of Isaac Life, who is about to begin his senior year at Carthage as a communications major. He spent 10 weeks this summer as an intern with CNN. He'll be telling us about that experience. Wednesday, rescheduled from last week, best-selling novelist Olin Steinhauer, author of an intriguing novel called The Middleman, very much inspired by current events. Rescheduled also from last week, next Thursday, Dr. Thomas Knorr, Professor Emeritus of History at Carthage, author of Soapy, a biography of G. Menin Williams, a very intriguing, unconventional public official who broke ties politically from his immensely wealthy family. And next Friday, Dr. Donald P. Ryan, author of Beneath the Sands of Egypt, Adventures of an Unconventional Archaeologist. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackandDrea.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu.